work as a columnist. He's also written several presidential biographies, one of which called President Kennedy, was described as the best nonfiction book of the year by Time magazine. So a very distinguished writer. He's on a book tour, of course, for his book. We have actually sold out the book, so you have to get it online, but he'll be glad to sign it for you afterwards. I've heard a broadcast of this particular lecture he gave elsewhere, and you're in for a really interesting evening, so do have your questions ready. And lastly, I'm a retired Air Force officer, so it makes sense I'm a little bit biased on this topic. I have taught the topic of the Berlin Airlift to many Air Force officers, and we continue to teach it because it's a very important lesson on the use of military force for constructive purposes. So without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Mr. Richard Reeves.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's nice to be back here for the, I think, third or fourth time, all of them stimulating. And I, I want to start by talking about why I did this book. The short answer would be Abu Ghraib, but I wanted to write a book about what I thought America was when I was growing up, what Americans did, what Americans didn't do, and why we did it. I had lived all over the world as a New York Times correspondent and as a writer, and also it happened that my wife ran refugee camps so that we were in some exotic places. And as the years went on, I could barely stand it when people began to hate Americans and hate America and talking about preemptive war and everything all the way to torture, because I thought that, I mean, things happen, but this is not what my country is about. And I was looking for a story to write about what I thought America was like and what Americans were. And I got far more than I bargained for. And as I was trying to prepare for or figure out what I was going to write about, I was reading a book called Post-War by a British scholar named Tony Judd, J-U-D-T. And it was a history of post-war Europe. And there were only two paragraphs on it in the Berlin Airlift. And when then I looked at David McCullough's biography of Truman, it was the same thing. It was as if it never happened. I mean, it just was passed over when it was one of the most amazing acts by an American president, Harry Truman, and one of the greatest humanitarian effort of all time, really, and a great, great adventure. I want to read three. I want to set up. I'm going to show. There are no young people. I teach at the University of Southern California, and of course, when thanks wasn't a very good year for us. But of course, my student. And the best part of this is my students. When I show them newsreels of the period, because they had no idea what a newsreel was, or how we found out what anything was going on. But I want to read three quotes that are at the beginning of the book. And one was in March of 1948, Stalin. There are not many Russian records existing anymore on the Berlin Airlift, because they tended to either not record or to destroy anything where they didn't do particularly well. But there are minutes of a meeting on March 19th, 1948, when Stalin said to the leaders of East Germany, let's make a joint effort. We can kick them out, them being the Americans, the British, and the French. As most of you, I'm sure, know, and some of that is here, Berlin after the war was divided into four occupation zones, three Allied zones, what we called Allied, and the Soviet zone. Because of its symbolic importance and the fact that it had kind of been the center of the world, in a way, for years, the Berlin itself, which was 110 miles inside East Germany, inside the Soviet zone, it was divided also into four sectors, divided between the Allies. Among the things that meant was that there were a million Soviet troops around Berlin. There were inside Berlin 6,000 American troops. We demobilized. When the war ended, all Americans wanted was bring the boys home, and we brought the boys home in the planes, buried the guns, dropped them into the ocean. But the Soviets had not paid their soldiers throughout the war. And so what they did was leave them in Eastern Europe and pay them in Eastern European and German currency, which was worth almost nothing, but it was a way for them to write it off. The second quotation, which was on June 29th, 1948, after hearing the Joint Chiefs of Staff, led by Omar Bradley, all of his cabinet, led by General George Marshall, and the new National Security Agency, which was created at that time, all said when the Russians had blockaded Germany, when they used all those troops to cut off the land routes, he asked for a vote. Every single one of those people voted not to do anything. They voted to leave Berlin. What could we do? As Robert Lovett, one of the wise men, said to Truman in that meeting, all the Russians need to overrun Berlin as shoes. And Harry Truman at the end of that meeting said, we're staying in Berlin, period. And when Lovett said, Mr. President, have you thought this through and whatnot, Truman got up and walked out of the room, and we began to move planes, find men, pilots, mechanics, weathermen, to run this extraordinary effort. And finally, this is a quote from a British lieutenant. We don't like to say this, but the airlift was actually a British idea. We didn't think it could be done. They thought it could be, that you could feed 2 million people and give them some electrical power, some heat with coal, medicines, etc. This is what John Curtis, a young lieutenant, later Air Marshal Sir John Curtis, said. It was great fun. We were all together again doing an important job. You'd be talking to some fellow and find out he'd been a lawyer in Manhattan 2 weeks ago. And there was a great deal of that on the American side. So this is more familiar to you than it is to my students, but this is 4 minutes of newsreels of the period, which give you an idea of what it looked like then and lay out the situation.
In June 1948, blockade.
Trains, barges, and road traffic was stopped.
The threat of starvation for 2 million citizens of West Berlin. Blockade imposed by the communists to force withdrawal of the Western Allied forces.
Is it possible that the Americans will be forced out of Berlin?
We are not going to be forced out of Berlin.
In your opinion, is there any danger of war, General?
I would not like to minimize the seriousness of the situation in Germany. In such a situation, there is always a danger. I consider it a small danger because the peoples involved do not really want war.
The people of Berlin headed for the Place de la République again last week to protest communist terror tactics directed against this city's freedom. Over a quarter of a million of them streamed in from all four sectors to make this the greatest of Berlin's freedom rallies. Here by the ruins of the Reichstag, symbol of German democracy, they assembled to put their case before the world. You people of the world, you people in America, in England, in France, in Italy, look at this city and see that you may not abandon this city, that you cannot abandon this city.
But the West does not withdraw. Instead, the Berlin airlift is launched by a combined Allied task force.
The Air Force assigned more than 300 airplanes and more than 20,000 men to the airlift. And Britain made a large contribution of both aircraft and personnel. It was an operation without precedent and a severe test of precision flying, of logistics, maintenance, communications, and weather service.
The air corridor to Berlin was narrow and dangerous. With 40 to 50 airplanes going through it simultaneously, they had to be accurately spaced. And until the late stages of the airlift, they were flown at five different levels, the levels being 500 feet apart. This called for extremely precise air traffic control.
Some of us had bombed Berlin, and now we were trying to keep the same city alive. It meant that we had to get more from each airplane and from each man than ever before.
The biggest item was coal for the utilities. It was packed in GI barracks bags. Second biggest item was made into pumpernickel, schaltstangle, and kuchen. We call it bread. And milk for the kids. Then medicines. Every ounce of cargo was checked.
A new agreement signed in New York between the USSR and the United States reaffirmed the removal of all restrictions on communications, transportation, and trade between West Berlin and the western zones of Germany.
Attention, attention. We have a communique about the lifting of the Berlin blockade. It was officially announced by the big four powers at 2 o'clock this afternoon that the blockade will be lifted on May 12th.
Correct time is 1 minute past midnight. The gates are being opened now, and the first vehicles are going through. The crowd in the background seem rather happy about the whole thing. There go the three British trucks. One, two,
no matter where I may go, I shall watch always with interest the part which Berlin will play in the formation of German government, and with complete confidence that its part will be a democratic part. Therefore, I shall not use the English word goodbye, but rather try to say to you, Auf Wiedersehen.
That, as I'm sure you know, was General Lucius Clay, who was the American military governor in Germany. When he left that day to go into retirement, 750,000 people stood along the route from the Rathaus, from the City Hall, to Tempelhof Airport. They stood silently at attention as his car passed over the time. It's hard for us to imagine now how this could have happened. And in fact, part of the reason was that at Potsdam, where the occupation policy for Germany was determined, there were no agreements on access to West Berlin. The Americans, the British, the French did not think that would be a great problem. Well, it turned out to be a great problem because the Soviets, when Stalin made up his mind that it would destroy communism in Eastern Europe if there was a window to the West in the middle, if the West, a Western-style economy built up and Eastern Europeans, East Germans could see it, that his side would eventually be driven out. And that was the reason that he wanted to, he was willing to go to this kind of trouble to drive us out. The three lines showing in there when Edward R. Murrow was talking were three aircraft corridors from the three Allied zones, American, British, and French, into Berlin, 20 miles wide those corridors were, and they were a result not of treaties at Potsdam, but of international air traffic safety rules, which the Russians abided by. The Russians harassed the planes. They fired anti-aircraft. They sent up barrage balloons. They set up fighters, but they did not do anything. Their feeling was, and they were probably right, that if they shot down any of the planes coming in, it would be the beginning of World War III. The debates about what to do with Germany were extraordinarily complicated, and among them was that Henry Morgenthau, the Secretary of Treasury of the United States, had created the Morgenthau Plan, which the French supported totally, which many Americans supported, and that was to force a pastoral Germany, not to allow Germany to reindustrialize, not to allow Germany to go to war. And part of that plan was that each German would be restricted to 1,500 calories a day so that they wouldn't have the energy to do things. So you were left in this situation. They were already they were still at that level from 1945 to 1948. One of the biggest problems was that people who were so disoriented, German people, as Curtis LeMay called it, Berlin was a city of zombies. And most of those zombies were women and children and old men. And one of the big problems was they would walk into cars or trucks because they were so disoriented from malnutrition. On the other hand, to carry that out, orders were given to the American occupation soldiers, the few thousand who were there, that they were to pour gasoline on the garbage at mess halls and other places so that the Germans could not eat it. In general, they refused to do that. These privates and corporals, 18 and 19 years old, refused to do that. In fact, they would stack up stacks of food and bring them to orphanages because these kids didn't see the Nazis. They saw a starving people, particularly starving women and children, so that, and Clay then was the force behind trying to introduce a new currency and an economy into West Germany and into West Berlin. The old Hitler Reichsmarks, as I said, were essentially worthless, so that we secretly printed new currency, and it was the introduction of that new currency, the announcement that, again, done by radios on jeeps, that Germans had to turn in their Reichsmarks, and they each were given 40 Deutschmarks, which is the current currency of Germany. The minute there was a real hard currency, it was actually backed up by the United States Treasury, things came out of hoarding, out of storage, and suddenly there were goods, there was food. Farmers, once again, would bring their food into Berlin because they'd be paid for it with money that was worthless. Until then, the people of Berlin had been trading whatever they had, rugs or what sometimes old family silver, in the countryside for food just to stay alive. So on June 24th, Stalin announces the blockade, or the blockade appears at midnight. Then we have the meeting at the White House where what are we going to do about this? And Truman stands by himself in saying we are not leaving Berlin. We have every right to be there. Omar Bradley, by the way, was the family. Lucius Clay ruled that many Americans had families in Berlin, and if any of our occupation troops or officers wanted to send their families home, they could do that, but they would have to go themselves. They could not stay in Berlin. Almost no one did that. The one family that was moved back was Omar Bradley's daughter and son-in-law and two children, because Bradley felt he could not function if there was a chance that the Soviets took his children and grandchildren hostage. And then, beginning on June 26, 1948, phone calls, teletypes, telegrams, and policemen knocking on doors all over America to call up the men who had bombed Berlin, the pilots, the mechanics, in addition to the ones who were still on active duty, which was a very small number. The rest were reserves, and it was like this, according to one of the pilots, a man named Edwin Geer. In Washington, the Air Force, having used up much of its personnel around the world, was preparing long lists of reservists and of civilians working for airlines. Edwin A. Geer, Jr., who just graduated from Alfred University in the upstate town of that name, was woken by a phone call at dawn. Lieutenant Geer, said a sweet-voiced Western Union operator. Nobody called him that since he returned home after flying B-24s bombing the Japanese in the Pacific. You have a telegram from the Air Force, and I'm going to read it to you, and I'll send it right over there. By direction of the President of the United States, you are ordered to report to active duty for the Berlin airlift, reporting to Camp Kilmer, New Jersey, within 48 hours. That happened all across the country in waves as we needed men and we needed planes. There were only 37 DC-3s, C-47s in Berlin when the blockade hit. A British pilot described them as a collection of parts flying in loose formation. But starting with those planes and any pilot they could grab, people suddenly who were air attachés in embassies all over the world were called, if they had multi-engine experience, were called into service in Berlin. It was called TDY, temporary duty, because it was assumed that the Russians were bluffing and that there would be a week or two of negotiations at the UN or someplace, and this thing would be worked out. As we know, though, that is not what happened. The story of the book is really about these men, some of whom are here, suddenly had begun new lives with new wives, with babies, with maybe going to college, maybe having bought a house, and suddenly they were called back for temporary duty, drove to whatever station they were assigned to, and their wives, many of them had them by then, and were left. It was called the Lost Wives Club. One of the members of the Lost Wives Club are Tom Flowers and his wife there. Tom was coming from Guam as a crew chief for U.S. Navy C-54 squadron. His wife, who lived in San Francisco, was leaving San Francisco to go to Guam. And this happened to family after family. And this is the Flowers, if you'll stand up, which I have to say, that Tom Flowers is wearing the same uniform. I hate him. Wearing the same uniform he retired in. Thank you for the service. I'm going to tell you some of the stories. But that was the real story. That this is what Americans did. This was the America I was a 10-year-old boy in. This was the country that did the right things because they were right, that led by example and not by by power. But it was so chaotic, excuse me, at the beginning of the airlift, there were very few planes, very few men until these people could arrive. And if you look now through the day books of the stations from which we flew, you come across again and again These guys, it was so tough, and I'll go into what it was like to fly into Berlin these days. But one of the notations I noticed, and many times pilots, George Naranchi from here in San Francisco was one of the pilots. If you should stand up too, these were the daring young men, and they were daring, and they didn't like to fill out papers either. So they would just give short they'd often wouldn't report what was wrong with the planes, and when they did, they kept it short. One of the entries I saw there was number 4 engine fire warning light turns on in flight, period. Corrected, period. Remove bulb. The conditions in landing originally at Tempelhof Airport. Tempelhof is a huge, actually beautiful, the bowl, a grass bowl, and it's surrounded on one side by what was then the largest building in the world. The terminal building at Tempelhof was 3/4 mile long and went down sevens in addition to what was above, went down, it was designed by Albert Speer, went down 7 stories, which included hospitals, a Messerschmitt factory, barracks, which was essentially impregnable. On the other side of the field are 7-story, still today, 7-story apartment buildings. It wasn't like we could knock down buildings in Berlin. 85% of the city had been destroyed. People were living in caves. People had one change of clothing, and the smell was of death because there were people rotting under that, bodies rotting under that rubble. It was something like what Haiti appears to be today. And the U.S. Air Force lowest safe standard for landing at that time was 40 to 1. That is, for every 1 foot you dropped in altitude, you should move forward 40 feet like this. Because of the way Tempelhof was, the clearance above those apartment houses was 17 feet. And pilots would always swear that there were tire treads on the roofs. But to get into that airfield and at a speed at which you could stop, the pilots had to fly 10 to 1. Every 10 feet, they could drop the foot. So it was as if they were dive bombing into the airport, and indeed they were. And they would then hit metal mats called Marston mats, because they were made in Marston, North Carolina. The planes would hit so hard, and at one point there was one landing every 90 seconds. In that particular airport, and one takeoff every 90 seconds, which means every 45 seconds a plane was coming or going. As the planes came down and hit, women with shovels in their hands, wearing evening gowns, wearing bathing suits, because they had no clothes, they only had one, would run out and try to tamp dirt and rocks into the ground before the next plane popped out of the clouds, and there are always clouds in Northern Europe, and the women would run off. Those same women, the rubble women, were the major labor force when we decided to build a third airport. We had Tempelhof, RAF Station Gatow, which was a little RAF airport they used to bring things into Cardiff to supply their own troops. And in 60 days, 17,000 Germans, mostly women, dressed that same way, built a new airport at Tegel, which is now the major airport in Berlin. But that was what it looked like. And what did it look like to the other side? I spent a lot of time in Germany. I love being a reporter. The idea that you can go into people's houses and they kind of tell you their stories and whatnot And particularly in this case, where it was old commies and even older Nazis, and believe me, both still exist, was one. So among the stories was a young German boy, exactly my age, named Wolfgang Samuel, who wrote this in a letter to a paper here in California, in Victorville, wrote this of his time. In 1948, I was a young refugee living in a rotting former Wehrmacht barracks located off the end of the runway at Fassberg. Fassberg was in the western zone. Cold, hunger, and fear of tomorrow, our steady companions. There were times when we thought we wouldn't survive until spring. The presence of the Americans on the streets of Fassberg brought a sense of security to us in that transcended all other aspects of our miraculous survival. They were so different from the soldiers I'd known. Those had been men with guns whose faces were hard. The airlift soldiers were not like that. They carried no guns, and they looked more like people to whom life had been good and who didn't mind sharing their good fortune with others. The one day when I was 13, my mother returned home accompanied by an American sergeant. "My name is Leo Ferguson," he said. "Please call me Leo." There's a lot of love and romance in this story. Leo Ferguson married Wolfgang Samuel's mother, and Wolfgang Samuel, who's a writer in his own right and aircraft historian, retired as a colonel in the United States Air Force. There were no Germans I talked to who could not remember everything about care packages when they first saw a care package. The airlift was extraordinarily popular at home. I think it's what reelected Truman in 1948. The Republicans were against the airlift. They just simply didn't think it would work. And two, they said, you may have heard this, they said it would cost too much to do. So that Tom Dewey and his foreign policy advisor, John Foster Dulles, were campaigning against the airlift, just as the American people were seeing themselves as they wanted to be seen. The war is over. As pilot after pilot told me, I'd rather feed people than kill them. And a farmer from New Hampshire named Noah Thompson told me a story. His roommate and best friend, he had flown 24 missions bombing Berlin. His roommate and best friend had been killed. His plane had been shot down. He parachuted to safety into a farm field in what was now what became Eastern Germany, and he was beaten to death by the people on the ground. That was very common for bomber pilots. That's what's happened to John McCain when he landed in Hanoi. People were trying to drown him in a lake when the army and the police were able to rescue them. And Thompson then flew over exactly the spot where his best friend was, thinking, my God, you know, I was trying to kill these people 3 years ago, and now I'm trying to save them. It's quite a world. And it was quite a world. Among the Germans who talked about the care packages, by the way, were the food that we had warehoused for the invasion of Japan. That's where the food came from. But one guy my age, again, who told me he could name everything as it came out of the box. His name was Helmut Kohl. He became the first chancellor of a united Germany. I want to tell one story, and then I'll talk about how it ended. Arlie Nixon was the chief pilot of American Airlines during the airlift, or as the airlift began. And he happened to be in an American Airlines plane in Europe at the time. He was called back to service without any paperwork or anything. They took the plane, stripped everything out of it, and Arlie Nixon's salary went from $550 a month, which was a lot of money in those days, to a captain's salary of $140 a month. The first day he was there, as the airlift began, he went into a cafe near the field, and as he went in, every German inside stood up, left their food, when it was a big deal having some food, and walked out. 2 weeks later, after the Germans realized, when they first heard the planes, they thought the Allies might be bombing again. 2 weeks later, when people realized, German people realized what the airlift was, Arlie Nixon walked back into the same cafe. Every German stood up, went to the bar, and got a stein of beer and brought it back and laid them in front of him to... he said, I couldn't drink that much beer in 6 months, but I tried. So there were men of history involved, Truman, Ernst Reuter, who we saw here. One of the better-kept secrets of the airlift, certainly the beginning, was that we were using German mechanics. We literally ran out of mechanics. William Tunner, the general running the airlift, got the permission to hire German mechanics, so that I'm going to mispronounce his name, but Jack Messier there was a 19-year-old American supervising a 15-man crew of German workers, all of them older than him, and obviously another guy doing exactly the same thing, same age, 18, Corky Colgrove from Colorado, had 15 German mechanics under him, one a former U-boat captain, two former Luftwaffe squadron leaders. He didn't know what to do with them. They knew more about everything than he did, so he taught them to speak in English, and the next day, as the officers came by, his 15 crewmen stood in a line and said, "Good morning, Major, you son of a bitch." Which was the only English they knew at the time. I'm going to stop by saying the Berlin airlift changed everything. It changed modern aviation. As I said, at one point, planes were taking off and landing every 45 seconds. At the largest airport in the United States, LaGuardia, there was 20 minutes between planes. In the end, the Allies delivered 2.5 million tons of food, of fuel, of medicine. They also would fly back with sick children to get them out of Berlin. There were 277,000 flights. It led to the founding, directly to the founding of NATO, the Mutual Defense Treaty, which probably prevented World War III. And led to the foundation of West Germany as a separate country. It was, said Clement Attlee, the British Prime Minister, when he visited it in the last week, a wonder of the world. And so it was. And then the daring young men I wrote about went back home after a year to pick up their lives again. And one of the big problems was they couldn't remember where they left their cars. And if they found the cars, they couldn't remember where they hid the keys, because none of them thought they were going to spend a year saving the people who had been trying to kill them. And I think that's what being an American was about when I was a kid, and I'd like to see it be that way for as long as we can know. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Richard Reeves. And I remind the listening audience, this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and we're listening to Richard Reeves, author of Daring Young Men, talking about the Berlin Airlift. And now we'll take your questions.
Can I introduce one more person before I do? Daniel Bunning, Dr. Daniel Bunning, became an educator, was the son of a colonel serving in Berlin. And on the unloading crews were Germans and displaced persons who wore U.S. Army fatigues dyed black. There was only one American among the group unloading those planes. And that American was Daniel Bunning, who said, his father said, "What are you doing after school?" And he said, it was Fassburg, right? Sella or Fassburg? Where you were loading.
The only American
So that was what a major. One of the reasons it was so unpleasant to fly was that pilots had to leave the windows and sometimes the doors open in rainy, wet, cold European winter because both flour and coal can explode spontaneously in closed quarters. Thanks. Thank you all.
Is this on? Yes. The question I had is, what was the motivation for Stalin eventually to give up on the blockade? What incentives or disincentives did he have for not continuing it?
It took us a long time to figure that out. We knew part of it right away. The Russians had always depended on General Winter. General Winter had defeated Napoleon. General Winter had defeated Hitler. And Stalin was sure General Winter, the Eastern European Winter, would end the airlift too. And he wasn't the only person who thought that. A lot of Americans thought it at the same time. So that was the reason he ended it at the time he did. The underlying reason was that the communists were not good capitalists, and they did not understand the entanglement of the economies of the East and the West until factories, it was far harder on work in the East than on the West because the factories of East Germany, East Berlin, depended on whether it was tungsten or light bulbs or whatever, depended on supplies from other parts of the country. And it was a failure, and they negotiated it out at the UN, but that's why he quit. The blockade worked both ways, and in the end, they were the losers. One of the reasons we bought so much coal in was to get some electric power 1 hour a day to allow some factories in West Germany to... You didn't want 2 million people not working.
During the latter stages of the Cold War, when I flew to Berlin, you could not fly directly. You had to go to Frankfurt first.
Right.
Are you familiar with that restrictions?
That's still true. Yeah. I don't think it will be true when they're finishing a new international airport south of Berlin. But, you know, anybody who's ever been in knows that Frankfurt Airport is hell. But part of the reason is that there's no direct flight. There weren't, and still aren't, international class airstrips and whatnot in Berlin.
Could you comment just briefly on the infrastructure and the logistics that had to be put in place on the ground to distribute food to several million people?
Yes, it was 2 million people. The Berlin airlift, so much was invented, modern ground control, modern landing techniques, modern radar control. But among the most important things it did, and William Tunner was an organizational genius, was create what we now know as electronic data interchange, that which is what Walmart, say, uses, or Kmart. And those companies and their systems were developed by airlift men after their service. And the idea that if you buy a basketball at Walmart, a series of things happen and go all the way back to China, where they make one more basketball. We do that by computers now. That's how modern distribution works. They did it by teletype and telephone, and recreated what later became known as EDI. That when one of those duffel bags of coal was thrown on that plane, another duffel bag was being filled in the Ruhr, and one was coming out of warehouses in Germany. We use normal German distribution systems, warehouses. We're Americans, and it was done privately, the distribution systems, and they work perfectly. And that was a large, again, the Soviets couldn't conceive that something like that could be done. But that's what they were doing with that bread in the film. The flour would be delivered to local bakers by trucks coming from the air bases. And the way this was thought out, and originally they were sending bread into Berlin, but bread is 30% water, which weighs a lot. So everything they got down to whatever the lowest possible weight was. And as opposed to Haiti, particularly, where that's the great problem, distribution, I mean, the Germans are efficient people.
Thank you. In the beginning of your talk, you spoke very eloquently about how the courage and the compassion of this operation showed people what was the best about America. Do you take that example then to today to advocate the use of the U.S. military for humanitarian missions, such that if we had examples of this type of courage today, right, it might remind people who we are, but using the U.S. military for that?
Yes, I think that I certainly don't want to use them in more wars. I mean, the military was the most efficient vehicle, and it still is in many ways, to handle this kind of humanitarian crisis. So, yes, I do. I'm thrilled. I'm not thrilled that Haiti is in such trouble, but I hope that we can once again show the world what we're actually like.
Can you comment on the mindset of the average Americans at the time, whether they were generally in favor of or against the airlift? You think with the war just being over and Berlin having been the cause of so much death and destruction that we wouldn't be in favor of helping them out? What were the people thinking when this was announced, and how were they convinced that it was actually worth doing and actually helping people in Berlin that were there to destroy them just previously?
Well, I can't explain, you know, what every African American was thinking or not, but there were African Americans involved. The Tuskegee Airmen were involved in the Berlin airlift as well. I'm so sorry. I think the average.
Like, was there any surveys done about people in favor?
Yes. The Gallup poll was 89% of the American people supported it. It was unbelievably popular, and as I mentioned, I do believe that's what reelected Truman. And the when one pilot, Gail Halverson from Utah, came to Temple Hall for the first time, he had a little Revere 8mm, you know, one of those wind-up old-fashioned movie cameras, and he loved to do that and whatnot. So when he first landed, he went around the perimeter of Temple Hall, and when he got halfway around where the apartment houses were, there were like 20, 30 kids standing there. And he talked to them a little bit. He knew a little bit of German. And then he had to run back. They were loading his plane, and the turnaround time was sometimes as little as 15 minutes. And he suddenly realized that none of those kids had asked him for anything or whatnot. And he had been around where children were begging in many parts of the world, and the only thing he had with him was a stick of Doublemint chewing gum, and he ran back to the kids and ripped it up into 10 pieces, which they then divided among themselves because the tin foil itself had some sugar on it. Some of these kids had never tasted sugar. They then asked him, could he do it again? And that led to what was called the candy bombing, which was using handkerchiefs as small parachutes to drop Baby Ruth bars or whatever in Germany. In the end, the American people sent 40 million tons, it couldn't all be used, of candy to Europe. And in terms of, when I said the British, I've always been something of an Anglophobe, I think, and even though that's where my family came from. But I realized in doing this piece of work that the English vices and virtues are the same thing, their failings and their strengths, the steadfastness or stubbornness that they simply won't move if they don't want to. And among the things that I discovered, which I found astounding, we set up rations for the Germans. We increased it during the airlift from 1,500 per person to 2,300 calories per person. It was rationed, of course. It was part of the distribution system. But at home in London until 1952, there was rationing in London, and they were getting less than the Berliners were. And they were supporting it just as strongly as we were. It was a big question of how we saw ourselves. And many people, post-traumatic stress didn't start with Iraq. I was stunned how many people I knew, men I met, who did not want to talk about their combat experiences, which is very common. Many people come back from war and won't talk about it. But they could talk about the Berlin airlift. As Gail Halverson said, I'm a Mormon boy from a dirt farm, and I'd much rather feed people than kill them.
Maybe I can ask a quick follow-up to that before you ask your question. Was it known in the behind the Iron Curtain about the airlift and other parts of Europe that were struggling whether or not to become democratic, Italy and Greece?
That's an interesting question. I don't know the full answer because a large part of it was – the answer has to be yes because even word of mouth over a year. But the propaganda war was so intense, and also we were so much better at it than they were. But that scene that showed the fella in the saying the airlift is over from a jeep, when the Russians came into Germany, they took everything into Berlin 2 months before us. They took everything that wasn't nailed down, including the power plants, all the construction equipment, and the so that there was nothing. I've lost the train of thought on the question.
About whether they knew about the airlift behind the
Iron Curtain. That they had the most powerful radio station in Europe, Radio Berlin, which was 200,000 watts. We had an 800-watt radio system that used telephone lines. And as part of the propaganda war, and a very important part of it, we created RIOS, Radio in the American Sector, which was with jeeps going from square to square to rebut the news that people were getting from Berlin, from Radio Berlin, if they were getting it, since they often had electricity for only an hour a day. But that keeping the people of Germany informed and confident that we were going to stay there was a huge part of the airlift.
I'm actually one of the 2 million people that have to thank you. You fed me.
They fed you, right.
You fed us. I was in Berlin. I'm born in Berlin, and I was there during the airlift. So, and of course, most of all, at that time, being that young, I remember the candy flyers. I lived very close to Tempelhof. Thank you very much.
My turn?
Yeah.
Were there any planes that were downed in enemy territory, so to speak?
Yes, there were. And there were 79 men died, 38 British, and as this adds up, it doesn't. There were a few more British than there were American, partly because they had larger crews than we did. We didn't normally use a navigator, and they did. And it was a different story every time a plane crashed in East Germany, which they did often. And one of the best stories that I came across was a captain named Kenneth Hawk Slater, who crashed in East Germany and was smuggled out by East Germans, who he bumped into. He was very badly hurt. And then they realized that he had lost his papers as they were getting closer to the Western Sector, and there were machine guns trained on them so that the East Germans who were with him had to leave too, because they were afraid if they found those papers, they'd figure out who had gotten them across. So yeah, there were a couple of dozen crashes into East Germany. Sometimes the Russians treated them well, sometimes they didn't. It was amazing. In one of the three flyers were held after one crash. Were being held in a Soviet barracks. It's a great story. And the Russians wouldn't give them up. And to try to negotiate out, they sent two Air Force officers disguised as doctors who said, the Russians said, okay, you can see them to see that they're healthy. The two guys went in the room where they were holding the three Americans. They put a chair against the door, jumped out the back window, ran around the front to the Jeep, and took off. But things like that were happening all the time. It was the human interchange between romance and danger. Was life was lived large.
We have time for one more question. Yes.
Was there any difficulty in recruiting enough pilots to handle this?
No. There was not. And one thing that worked in our favor, I mean, one small thing which I didn't know until I did this, was in those days, since most of the airline pilots were either former military or reservists, and this is true, too, they took 18 air traffic controllers from Washington National Airport, who were all civilians, who all had done their service and volunteered to do that. But it was kind of amazing. And those airline pilots, some of them just happened to be available because in those days we flew fewer planes commercially in the winter than in the summer because there were no systems. It was too dangerous. Between bad sky and snow and ice and whatnot. And those were all of the problems that were worked out by the airlift under duress so that after the airlift we flew as much in the winter as in the summer. But I never came across a single, maybe some of these guys know, I never came across a single person who had already done their duty and wasn't in the reserves who said no. That doesn't mean it was fun. It was rainy, it was cold, it was dangerous. All of the flights were done by instrument flying. That was one of the innovations they used so that because General Tunner wanted absolute control of how far apart the planes were from each other and that they were all flying at the same speed in the same way. So he didn't want pilots flying under VFR, visual flight rules. He wanted them flying under control, and that was enormously improved by the airlift. Aviation was totally different after the airlift than before.
Great. Well, that draws our program to a close, and I'd like to thank Richard Rees for his wonderful tale of the Berlin airlift, and also to those men and women who served in the air and on the ground to make the operation happen, my thanks to you. Once again, this has been a program, the Commonwealth Club of California, and we are now adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.